Om sahana vavatu sahanau bhunaktu sah viryam karavavahai tejasvi navadhitamastu ma vidvishavahai. Om shanti 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 narayanam namaskritya naram chaiva narottamam devim sarasvatim chaiva tato jayamudirayet. Om. Good, welcome back. We are finishing this current chapter in which Bhishma gives us very profound and somewhat philosophical discourse to Yudhishthira. And the discourse has to, as we've seen in prior classes, to distinguish between Atma and Anatma, self and not self, to distinguish between knower and known, or to use the words used here, to distinguish between kshetrajna, the knower of the field of experience, and kshetra, the field of experience. And as we've discussed before, on the surface, this would seem to be a very abstract philosophical discussion, but it's not. And that's what we're going to see today, is the practical consequences of this knowledge. We've mentioned before that this knowledge is unlike other kinds of knowledge. Other kinds of knowledge makes you well-informed. You can be well-informed about medicine, about engineering, about computers. You can be well-informed about politics, although that's rather aggravating, I think. But all of that knowledge merely makes you well-informed. It doesn't solve the problem of suffering. The knowledge that Bhishma is imparting to Yudhishthira is a knowledge that actually solves the fundamental problem of suffering. Now, if you wonder, how can that be? How can any kind of knowledge put an end to suffering? Just to recall, the big picture of Advaita Vedanta is we suffer having failed to recognize our innate divinity, having failed to recognize our true nature as Satchidananda Atma. Because of that ignorance, we suffer. And if there's ignorance that makes us suffer, the solution, just allow me to poke fun at this, if the problem is ignorance of your true nature, the solution cannot be to do yogasanas. In fact, I've told this joke before, but it's Pooja Swamiji's joke. Allow me to tell it again. He said, if you're ignorant, there's actually a downside to doing, especially the shirasasana, this headstand. So his argument went like this. When you do shirasasana, more blood runs to your head, which makes your mind work more, but he complains that if you're already ignorant and your mind works more, you're just going to be more enmeshed in ignorance. Anyway, you get the point. The problem is ignorance, in particular, what he called self-non-recognition. And if the problem is self-non-recognition, the solution is knowledge. The traditional metaphor that's used for that all the time is a lady who lost her necklace. And she's looking everywhere for her lost necklace. Where is it? She looks in every room of the house. She's looking inside, outside. She's looking everywhere. And she's suffering because she thinks she has lost her precious necklace. Of course, it's been around her neck all the time. That shows how ignorance can cause suffering and how knowledge can be the solution to the problem of suffering. So that is a topic we are concluding now. There are just three verses left in this current chapter. Bhishma continues to teach this to Yudhishthira. Indriyais tu pradipartam, kurute buddhi saptamaihi, nirvicheshtara jhanad bihi, paramatma pradipavata. So, Yudhishthira is coming to his conclusion here about how knower and known are utterly distinct from each other. He says, and utterly distinct means whatever, and we need to set this up a little bit, whatever is known to you seems to become a source of suffering. If your car is known to you and it has a flat tire, it becomes a source of suffering. If your body is known to you and it doesn't have a flat tire, it has a damaged knee joint, then your body becomes a source of suffering to you. If your mind is known to you, and your mind has not just a problem, has a whole litany of problems, from starting from childhood, all of these problems have been building up. But the question is this, that, and the question that Yudhishthira is addressing is this. The problem of the car belongs to the car and not the knower of the car. The problem of your knee belongs to the knee and not the knower of the knee. The problem of the mind belongs to the mind and not the knower of the mind. The knower is utterly unaffected by what it knows. Just like light, sunlight. Sunlight shines on everything. Sunlight is utterly unaffected by what it shines upon. Swami Chinmayananda, my Paramaguru, loved this metaphor. He said that sunlight shines on the holy Bhagavad Gita. Sunlight doesn't become more holy. Sunlight shines on a filthy gutter. Sunlight doesn't become defiled. Sunlight is utterly unaffected by what it shines upon, by what it reveals. So too, the knower. The knower means your consciousness. Kshetrajna, the knower of all your experiences. Look at the last line. That one here is called Paramatma. What a big word. And we'll see more about that. Atma, the true self. How it is Paramatma, we'll hold off until the next verse. So that Atma, that true self, is Pradipavat, like a lamp. Like the sun illumines without being affected, so too a lamp on the altar illumines without being affected by what it illumines. So that knower, Paramatma, is Pradipavat. It illumines, and in the first and second line, Kurute Pradipartam. Kurute, it functions, Pradipartam, for the sake of illumining. That lamp, the true self, Atma, the knower, consciousness, illumines like a lamp for the sake, Pradipartam, for the sake of illumining. For the sake of illumining what? Whatever is known to you. Right now, I am known to you. How am I known to you? Through your five senses. You see me, you hear me, etc. So, indriyaihi tu. So through your indriyas, through your five, actually not five senses, we discussed this before, six. What is the sixth? Antahkarana, the mind. So the five senses and the mind, buddhi saptamaihi, along with the seventh. And what is the seventh? Buddhi, intellect. Five senses plus one mind plus one intellect, all of these. And all of these are nirvicheshtaihi. Nirvichesta means inert. Ajnanabhihi, unconscious. The mind and senses are stuff. Here we have to understand something according to the ancient worldview. In the ancient worldview, stuff comes in two flavors. One flavor is material, physical, tangible stuff. The other flavor was non-material, intangible. And the difference we make is between sthula bhutas, things made of physical elements, and sukshma bhutas, things made of subtle elements. And just to make this very, very clear, and you've heard me give this metaphor before, your brain is made of sthula bhutas. Your brain weighs about 2 pounds. How much do your memories weigh? Mind, your sense organs, your ability to see, hear, taste, touch, and smell, all of your mental faculties, they absolutely exist, but they are non-physical existences. By the way, do you know your mind? In a manner of speaking, you know your mind better than you know your brain. You've never seen your brain, unless you've had an MRI or something and get a picture of it. But we don't immediately, we can see our bodies, but we don't necessarily see our brains. The point is that just as your body is known to you, your body is made of physical stuff, your mind and senses are also known to you, but they're made of subtle stuff. Physical stuff, subtle stuff. Physical stuff is made of physical elements. Subtle stuff is made of subtle elements. Physical stuff is inert. Acheshtaihi ajanadbihi. Picking up these two words. Physical stuff is inert. It is the known. It is not a conscious knower. So too, subtle stuff. Subtle stuff is also inert. It's not conscious, it's stuff. Well, your mind and senses is made of subtle stuff. It's just stuff. It's not sentient. It gains sentiency from the consciousness. Do I want to do that here? Yeah. It gains sentiency from consciousness. Here's the metaphor that's used so often, very important Vedantic metaphor. And many of you will recognize this metaphor instantly. What is this? Bucket. A bucket full of water. The physical bucket is made of physical stuff. It represents your body. The water in the bucket represents the subtle stuff in your physical body. Means it represents your 5 senses, the 6th, your antakarana, and the 7th, your buddhi. So the water in this bucket represents your mind. Notice they're both stuff. Physical stuff, non-physical stuff. Notice physical stuff has a definite form. Body has a definite form. Non-physical stuff has a flexible form. What is the form of water? Depends on what you pour it into, right? Flexible stuff. So that's the difference. Physical stuff is a fixed form. Non-physical stuff will conform to the size of that in which it's poured, that in which it abides. So what is the shape of your subtle body? It fills up the physical body. It assumes that form. Anyway, body is made of physical stuff, mind is made of subtle stuff, and up here, as you know in this metaphor, is the sun. The sun shines on this bucket full of water, and the water in the bucket reflects the sun. And the water reflecting the sun thinks, I am a source of light. Pretty confused water, don't you think? Pardon the metaphor, but it's a nice metaphor. If the water could think, like your mind can think, the water would say, I am a source of light. Just as your mind thinks, I am a source of consciousness. The water thinks, I am bright, being illumined by the sun. Your mind thinks, I am conscious, being illumined by the knower, by consciousness. This is a confusion. And to make the confusion more complex, this water represents your mind. Is your mind very simple or very complex? Right? So this water is equally complex. In particular, if we say that the mind is composed of three gunas, sattva, rajas, and tamas, so this mind, composed of sattva, rajas, and tamas, reflects light, but reflects light according to its nature. Starting with tamas, tamas would be like a lot of pollution and dirt in the water. Rajas would be like lots of vegetation and ripples in the water. Sattva, in this metaphor, would be the purity and stillness of the water. Notice the condition of the water affects, watch this, the condition of the water affects what? Does it affect the sun? Not at all. What does it affect? The reflection. And the reflection is your experience. Your experience is affected by the condition of your mind. Consciousness is not affected by the nature of your mind. Your experience is known because of consciousness. Don't get these two things confused. Experience is known to you, right? Kshetra means field of experience. Whatever you experience is known to you. Don't confuse experience and consciousness. Experience is known to you because of consciousness. So experience is definitely affected by the nature of your mind. Consciousness is definitely not affected by the nature of your mind. And that is the significance of this verse, where this is really the conclusion of this chapter, where Bhishma points out that consciousness, the knower, is utterly unaffected by the known. The known including the bucket, which has a defective knee, the mind, which has all kinds of problems and defects. None of these problems affect consciousness. And then he just to make it even more vivid, he makes the distinction between that which shines and that which doesn't. The sun shines. The bucket does not shine. The water in and of itself does not shine. Bucket is made of physical stuff. Water is made of... I'm mixing my metaphors. Body is made of physical stuff. Mind is made of subtle stuff. They're both made of stuff. They're both nirvichesta, insentient. They're both ajanat, unknowing, unconscious. Just a quick note here before we move ahead. How obvious the distinction between that which is sentient and insentient, that which is conscious and that which is not, that which is knower and known. It would seem to be so obvious, but how do we manage to get so confused? Notice that, again, go back to that water. That water says, I am the source of light. Huh? Confused, total confusion. Your mind says, I am the source of consciousness. Total confusion. And a kind of confusion that leads to suffering. So all of this is meant for what purpose? To understand that who you are is the conscious being, the knower, utterly independent of the known, utterly unaffected by the known. This is a take-home message, very, very important message. And after giving this very important message, then Bhishma concludes by talking about the consequence of this knowledge. He says, Tyaktva yah prakritam karma, tyaktva yah prakritam nityam atmavratir munihi, nityam atmavratir sarva bhutatma bhutasyat, sarva bhutat sagachet paramam gatim, sagachet sahagachet paramam gatim. Saha, the one who knows this, gachet, would reach paramam gatim, the highest goal. Such a person would gain enlightenment. Who, end of the second line, he's called munihi. Muni can mean sage, but it has an etymological meaning, which is a wise person. So muni can mean sage in general, but in a more limited context, this context, it means a wise person. That wise person, what about that wise person? Nityam, always, atmaratihi, always reveling in himself. How and why? First line, yaha tyaktva, that one, tyaktva, having given up prakritam karma. Prakritam means ordinary. Prakritam karma, ordinary actions. Ordinary actions are what kinds of actions? Ordinary actions are those seeking happiness, contentment, joy, peace, love, etc. That's what life is about. So all of that is called prakrita karma. Now, prakrita is not a compliment. Prakrita means ordinary in the sense of lowly. Seeking happiness, contentment, and peace. Go back to the earlier metaphor. That's that lady seeking her necklace. Here's the point. When she's seeking her necklace, is she having fun? Is she having a good day? She's very upset. In the same way, someone who seeks happiness in life is probably not having much fun because there are so many obstacles and difficulties in the path, obstructing the path to getting the happiness you want. It's inevitable. Whatever you seek in life, there will be one or more obstacles blocking your way. It's not going to be fun. So therefore, prakritam karma, the ordinary action of seeking happiness in life, is considered a very lowly condition because it's a life of suffering. It's a life of seeking and not finding. And what I mean by that is what you're ultimately seeking is perfect peace and uninterrupted contentment, correct? You're seeking perfect peace. You're seeking uninterrupted contentment. Where will you find that? You're seeking it. Where will you find it? You go to this mall down the road? Will you find perfect contentment? Uninterrupted contentment? Where to go? Starbucks? You get the point. So you go to some elaborate place, some exotic holiday location, will you find perfect peace and uninterrupted? Here's the problem. You are seeking what is impossible to find. Just like that lady is seeking all over her house and inside and outside, it's an impossible quest. She already has what she wants, so her whole quest is based on ignorance and just causes suffering in the same way. What you truly seek, the true source of happiness, contentment, and peace is within. Therefore, prakritam karma is seeking happiness and contentment where it's not. The lady looking for her necklace in the house and outside. You seeking happiness and contentment at the mall or through some exotic holiday. This is the source of suffering in life. Tyaktva, giving up that confusion. The munihi, the wise one, becomes atmaratihi, revels in the true source of contentment, happiness, and joy, which is within. And that muni is sarva-bhutatma bhutat, sarva-bhutatma bhutaha syat. Big words. That, and by the way, this connects to that paramatma, which I didn't explain completely. So this sage is sarva-bhuta atma. He has become the atma, self, of sarva-bhuta of all beings. That's the literal meaning of that word. So we got two bhutas here, which have Sanskrit is such a language. Bhuta comes twice, so two different meanings. So bhutaha syat, he has become. This bhuta means become. This bhuta means creature. So be ready for that. Words have different meanings in English. Words have different meanings in Sanskrit. So that wise person, Bhuta, is one who has become the Atma, self, of Sarva-Bhuta, of all beings. What does it mean to be the self of all beings? All beings are like these buckets. How many beings are there? Lots. How many buckets? By the way, don't expect me to draw lots of buckets, but anyway, just a few. So these few buckets represent all buckets, represent all beings. Each bucket is full of water, and each bucket, you've seen this before, each bucket reflects the sunlight, right? Many reflections represents many experiences. How many suns? How many is consciousness? That's it. One consciousness, many experiences. One sun, many reflections. One consciousness, many experiences, many reflected consciousnesses. The muni is one who knows I am consciousness. The one consciousness which shines and is manifest in all beings. That's what that big word means. Sarva-bhutatma-bhutaha. The wise one is one who recognizes himself as the atma, the self, the consciousness. Sarva-bhutani in all beings. The one who recognizes himself or herself as the one consciousness present in all sentient beings. That one is enlightened. And that's what that word paramatma in the prior verse. So atma can refer to the light on a given bucket, we can say as atma, but the light that reflects on all buckets can be called paramatma. Again, the light shining on one bucket, we can call atma, but the one light that shines on all buckets, paramatma, And is there a difference between the one light shining on one bucket and the light that shines on all buckets? Atma is Paramatma. There's no difference whatsoever. The enlightened one knows this. Saha gachet paramam gatihi. And he or she reaches the highest goal. And then the last verse. Etad buddhva bhavet buddhaha buddhva bhavet kiman yat buddha lakshanam kiman yat buddha vignaya taddhi manyante vignaya taddhi krita kritya manishinaha krita etat buddhva, having known this, having known himself or herself to be the one consciousness which illumines all minds. Think about that just for a moment. The one consciousness which illumines all minds. Knowing oneself to be that consciousness, etad buddhva. Then what is the consequence of that? Bhavet buddhaha. You become Buddha. Now, Buddha does not only mean that saintly person from 2,500 years ago. Buddha is a past passive participle, and grammatically, it means one who has woken up. That's literally what it means. Buddha means one, I can't help it, this joke comes into my mind. There was a, what is that? A problem of pronunciation. I was told this by one of my Desi students, who said he was at work with one of his non-Indian colleagues, and his non-Indian colleague kept talking about Buddha. He said there was this great enlightened sage called Buddha. And my student said, "Who? Buddha? What? What are you talking about? Buddha?" And my student said, "Oh, you mean Buddha." And his colleague said, "No, Buddha." Just a problem of pronunciation. Buddha literally means one who has awoken, one who has emerged from the sleep of ignorance, one who is enlightened. So, etad buddhva, knowing this, bhavet buddhaha, one becomes Buddha, one becomes enlightened, one becomes awake to reality. Kim anyat buddha lakshanam. Buddha lakshanam, the definition of enlightenment. Buddha lakshanam. Kim anyat, how else would you define enlightenment? If notice the term we use, the English translation, enlightenment. What exactly does enlightenment mean? With when I'm teaching children, I joke with them, when somebody is enlightened, does it mean they glow in the dark? When someone is enlightened, does it mean they lost 25 pounds? So, what does it mean to be enlightened? It means to be free from the ignorance that causes suffering. Got it? This is it. So to be enlightened means to be free from the particular kind of ignorance. If just because you have two PhD degrees and a lot of postgraduate work, does it mean you're very knowledgeable? Probably not enlightened. Maybe enlightened, but not enlightened because of the two PhD degrees and all of the other things. You can be enlightened through these teachings. Okay. Etad buddhva, having discovered your true self, to be the one consciousness that illumines all minds, bhaved buddhaha, one becomes enlightened, kim anyat buddha lakshanam, there's no other way to define enlightenment, vijnaya, having known this, tadhi vijnaya tat, having known this truth, he indeed manyante, such people, what kind of people? Manishinaha, such wise people, manishinaha, such, by the way, this is singular in a translation, it's all plural. Such wise people, manyante, are considered kritta krityaha. Beautiful expression. Kritta kritya. Kritya is what is to be done. Kritya. You see that word? Krita kritya. Krita means done. Kritya means to be done. A little terse, so understand the meaning. Kritya, that which is to be done, refers to your to-do list, or what some people call bucket list. Is that the expression he used? So your kritya, your to-do list, your bucket list, everything you want to accomplish in this life, suppose it's all krita, done. Can you imagine having this long list, thousands of items, and then one day realizing, I don't need to do any of that for the sake of happiness, contentment, and peace. Kritta kritya. This is what it means. Doesn't mean that you actually do every one of those thousands of items. All of those thousands of items are for the sake of contentment and happiness. Suppose you gain perfect contentment and happiness without doing all those thousand items, then doing those thousand items becomes optional. You can still do them, but your happiness doesn't depend on doing them. That's what this kritta kritya means. Very beautiful term. Means, nice simple translation, fulfillment. Total and complete fulfillment, that is the consequence of these teachings. And with this, this chapter comes to an end, this chapter in which Bhishma taught this particular kind of knowledge which puts an end to suffering. Now, the next chapter, I'll start introducing the next chapter now, Bhishma immediately shifts to meditation without Yudhishthira even asking a question. Most of these chapters begins with Yudhishthira's question. Here, Bhishma doesn't even wait for Yudhishthira's question. He just immediately switches in the very next chapter to teaching meditation. Why? Bhishma is addressing one of the most common problems for all spiritual seekers. And that is... In this verse, he says, one who gains this knowledge becomes fulfilled, totally and completely fulfilled. Now, you've gained this knowledge. None of you can say, oh, Swamiji, I didn't understand what you were saying. You can't say that. You understood. I mean, you all speak English. And you speak English well, and you understood everything I said. You even understood the nuances of what I said. But then, you may find yourself still subject to suffering. What's going on? On one hand, you understood and Bhishma concludes by saying, etad buddhva bhavet buddhaha. You should all be buddhas. You should all be enlightened. And in one sense, you are. In one sense. You've understood. On the other hand, you may not be krita kritya. You may not be fulfilled. So how is it possible to be buddha, enlightened, but not krita kritya, not fulfilled? And to introduce the next chapter on meditation, let's distinguish two kinds of knowledge. Two kinds of knowledge, one kind, and allow me to use the Sanskrit terminology because it's kind of important. So one kind of knowledge is called, and I know these are big words, but they're important. Jnana means knowledge. Paroksha means indirect. And we're going to contrast it with the opposite of paroksha. Indirect is obviously aparoksha. Aparoksha means what? Not indirect, double negative. Not indirect means direct. So we're going to talk about these two terms a little bit now. Paroksha jnanam, indirect knowledge, and aparoksha jnanam, direct knowledge. Suppose the lady knows no one has entered my house, so my necklace must be here somewhere. This is what she thinks. No one has entered my house, which means no one could have removed my necklace. She reasons, my necklace must certainly be here somewhere. With that recognition, does she have a paroksha, direct knowledge, or does she have paroksha jnanam, indirect knowledge? It's indirect, right? She says, my necklace must be here somewhere. She knows. She knows her necklace is here. But that's indirect. Why? She hasn't really seen it on her own neck. And this is the problem in Vedanta, and that is we all start off with paroksha jnanam, indirect knowledge. And indirect knowledge can be complete. You completely understood what we just discussed. All this sun shining on different buckets is a little complicated, but you understood it, and you understood it well, and you understood the consequences of it, the implications of it. You understood. Then, why are you not Buddha? I may be wrong. So, if you're not Buddha, why not? And because to be Buddha, remember Buddha in the sense of enlightened, awoken from the sleep of ignorance, to be Buddha is a product of which kind of knowledge will make you Buddha? Will indirect knowledge, paroksha jnana, make you Buddha? And kritta kritya, fulfilled? Only direct knowledge, aparoksha jnanam, will make you Buddha, and kritta kritya, just like that lady, is not going to be content until and unless she gains a direct knowledge of that necklace hanging on her neck. The indirect knowledge, oh, my necklace must be here someplace, is not going to solve the problem. In the same way, the paroksha jnanam that you now have, you all have paroksha jnanam. But it's not enough. So now the question becomes, what will it take to convert paroksha jnanam into aparoksha jnanam? Got it now. This is our topic. And this is how we're introducing the next chapter on meditation. And it has to do with this. It has to do with our manner of thinking. If Atma, consciousness, is a subject matter to be known, you will know Atma as a subject matter. See what I'm saying? If Atma is, like, there's so many things to be known, there's a table to be known. What is this table? It's made of wood, it has a top, it has legs, etc. It's brown in color. What is Atma? Oh, Atma is consciousness. What kind of consciousness? Sat, Chit, Ananda. Sat, unborn, uncreated. Chit, consciousness. Ananda, full and complete. Notice how parallel these expressions are. The table is brown wood. Brown wood with four legs. How's that? The table is brown wood. Watch this. The table is brown wood and four legs. Atma is Sat, Chit, Ananda. Table is brown wood, four legs. Atma is Sat, Chit, Ananda. Brahman is Satyam, Jnanam, Anantam. Same thing, right? This is Paroksha Jnanam, indirect knowledge. Why is it indirect knowledge? Because we're just as the table is an object out there that we're characterizing, what we're doing is a terrible mistake of turning Atma into another object in the world. Just as there are so many other objects in the world, Atma is one more. You say, Aurek cheese. One more thing out there in the world is Atma. And this orientation is what prevents us from getting direct knowledge. We have to shift our perspective so that Atma is not Aurek cheese. It is you, the conscious observer, the knower. This is what's required, a shift of perspective. I'll make one more comment, then we'll start the next chapter. And I've told this before, but it's just such a nice memory. When I was a student at Arsha Vidya Gurukulam, a very dear friend of mine and I, we would have long, long discussions about all this Vedanta stuff. And he had this really, he loved Sanskrit, and he was really good at Sanskrit grammar, and he made a grammatical metaphor, which was really perfect. He said, the problem is we think in the third person when we should be thinking in the first person. Third person, grammatically, he, she, or it. What about the table? Is the table a he, she, or it? In English, it is an it. In Hindi, maize. I don't know the gender of maize. You tell me whether it's masculine or feminine. It has some gender in Hindi. But in English, it has no gender, so it is an it. Now, is Atma a he, she, or it? Well, here we get in, now we get into some real trouble. First of all, grammatically, Atma happens to be pulling, masculine in gender. Oh, Atma is a he. Grammatically, okay, it's just like you have to tell me. Maize is Trilinga? What, in Hindi? Everything? It is, right, okay. So this maize, this table, is feminine in gender. So we call it she. But you say, to call the table she is pretty arbitrary. It's just a table. The gender of maize just happens to be feminine. All right? But the table is just a table. Similarly, the gender of the noun Atma happens to be masculine, but it's just an accident of language. Just as the table being feminine in gender, in the same way Atma being masculine in gender, they're just accidents of language. It means nothing. Is there any difference between a male table and a female table? In the same way, there is no male Atma and female Atma. Atma has no gender. Bodies have gender. Minds have gender. Atma has no gender. So, coming back, we said the table I ask as a table, a he, she, or it. We'll say the table is an it. Is Atma a he, she, or it? None of the above. Right? The table isn't it. Atma is not a he, she, or it. Because he's and she's are all out there, and it's are insentient. Atma is not insentient, so it's not an it. Atma is not a he or a she, because Atma doesn't have gender. Atma is not a person wandering around out there. Atma is not a he, she, or it. Atma is an I, first person. This is the really important step we have to make now to convert this paroksha jnana into aparoksha jnana. We have to change our perspective so that we're no longer treating Atma as a he, she, or it, third person, so that we are seeking to understand Atma in the first person. Make sense now? To understand Atma in the first person, meditation is crucial. Because meditation means turn your attention towards self, towards I. Sri Ramana Maharshi had this beautiful, beautiful and profound teaching. He said, find the source of I. Find out that from which the sense of I arises. The way he explained it is, in your mind is that sense of I. We call it ahankara. Ramana instructed, find out the source of that sense of I. Seek the root of I-ness. It's a nice way of putting it. Seek the root of I-ness. And isn't that what meditation is all about? Exactly. Which is why the very next chapter, without any interruption, without even a question on the part of Yudhishthira, Bhishma launches into this instruction on meditation. It goes on for two chapters, and we will start that right now. He begins, notice, without a question on the part of Yudhishthira. Most of these chapters open with Yudhishthira's question, but here Bhishma, having imparted this knowledge, knows that it's crucial to close the gap between paroksha jnanam and aparoksha jnanam, so immediately he shifts to this discussion on meditation. Bhishma vacha, hanta vakshyami te partha, hanta vakshyami te dhyana yogam chaturvidham, dhyana yogam chaturvidham. Yam jnatva shashvatim siddhim, yam jnatva gachanti paramarshayaha, gachanti param. Hanta, O dear one, partha, O Yudhishthira, te, unto you, vakshyami, I will teach. I will teach you what? Dhyana yogam. I will teach you the practice of dhyana, meditation, which is chaturvidham, fourfold. Turns out he really doesn't, there's no fourfold discussion in this chapter or the next. The commentator says it's fourfold based on different, we use the term in our meditation class, alambana. Alambana means what? Focal point of meditation. So depending on what you meditate upon, if you meditate upon an image of God, if you meditate on your mantra, whatever it is, so according to the object of meditation, meditation can be chaturvidham, fourfold, but it turns out that's not a major topic in this chapter. And he says, in the last line, paramarshayaha, the great parama, Rishi. Nice, you have to get the Sanskrit right. Parama plus Rishi becomes Paramarsha. And then in plural, Paramarshayaha. Be nice to learn a little Sanskrit, wouldn't it? then you can make sense of all of this. Parama plus rishi in the plural becomes paramarshayaha. The great rishis gachanti. They reached what? Shashvatim siddhim. Eternal completeness and perfection. Yam yatva. Having known this practice of meditation. Not really having known it. Having practiced it. It says yam yatva. But it's better yam kritva. Having performed this meditation, they gained perfection. Tatra svadhyaya samshlishtam, tatra svadhyaya ekagram dharayen manaha, ekagram dharayen pindikrityendriyagramam, pindikrityendriyagramam. Asina kashtavan munihi, asina kashtavan. Tatra, with regard to this practice of meditation, swadhyaya samslishtam manaha. You have to connect that to the word manaha in the second line. Manas, a mind, dharayet, should be concentrated, ekagram, to one point. This is the beginning of the introduction to meditation. Your mind should be dharayet, should be concentrated, ekagram, to one point. But you have that long word in the first line. Swadhyaya samslishtam. Samslishta means refined, perfected, educated. Educated through swadhyaya, through your own study. So what he's saying is, after studying Vedanta, then you should meditate. Notice the order. So swadhyaya, your personal study, samslishtam, after performing the scriptural study, then ekagram dharayet manaha, then making your mind one-pointed, then concentrating your mind in meditation. There's an important point being made here, and that is, can meditation in and of itself make you enlightened? This is a common confusion, very common confusion. So we've already determined that the problem that enlightenment solves is a problem of ignorance, right? Knowledge, atmajnanam, self-knowledge, removes that self-non-recognition, which is the root of suffering. Knowledge removes ignorance, therefore you become Buddha, you become enlightened through this knowledge. Can you become Buddha through merely, as Buddha did, the historical Buddha sat at the foot of a tree and meditated. And then based on that, people will say, hey, look at that, Buddha got meditated just by meditating. If you say that Buddha got enlightened just by meditating, then you don't know anything about Buddha. You don't know that before he sat at the foot of that tree, he spent years studying scriptures, studying Hindu scriptures, right? He studied Upanishads. He studied, I don't know if he studied Bhagavad Gita, but he most certainly studied Upanishads. Those were the scriptures available to him at the time. Not only that, but he practiced intense tapasya, intense austerities. He did all of that first before he sat at the foot of that Bodhi tree. Some of you have been to Bodh Gaya. You can see the ancestor of You can see the tree that stands there, presumably from the original tree. Notice Buddha first studied and did all this tapasya before doing meditation. That wasn't accidental. And here's the point. If you sit down to meditate, let me make this point a little bit more clear. If you sit down to meditate with your mind full of ignorance, what exactly will you be meditating on? Right? If you sit down to meditate with your mind full of ignorance, how can you emerge from that meditation freed from ignorance? You require teaching to destroy ignorance. Teaching destroys ignorance. Meditation serves a very different purpose. And we're going to discuss this much more in the coming classes. But let's be very clear. In fact, we had this discussion in a satsang recently, and that is, knowledge is born of the technical term is pramana. Pramana means a source of knowledge. Knowledge comes from a source. One source of knowledge are your five senses. Your five senses gives you knowledge about the world around you. Another source of knowledge is inference. When you see smoke rising from the mountain, you infer the presence of fire. You gain knowledge of fire through inference. All of science is based on that kind of inference. So through our five senses and through inference, we gain knowledge about the world around us. Notice that inference is based on sensation. You see the smoke and infer the fire. If you didn't see the smoke, could you infer the fire? Okay, all of it, this is a big complicated topic, but I'm just giving it to you in brief here. All worldly knowledge is based on perception and inference. These are the sources of worldly knowledge. But we've already observed, Atma is not one more thing in the world. Atma is not, aur ek cheez, nahi. Atma is not one more thing out there in the world to be known. Therefore, Atma is not known through the means of perception or inference. Perception and inference are valid sources for worldly knowledge. Perception and inference are not valid sources for knowledge of Atma. Then how can we gain knowledge of Atma? If our five senses won't be adequate, if inference won't be adequate, how to gain knowledge of Atma? What exactly are we doing? We're studying Scripture. Scripture is considered a valid means of knowledge for things which are not in the world. For things which are in the world, we have sense perception and inference as valid means of knowledge, sources of knowledge, but for knowing the true self, Atma, we require Scripture. Now, to conclude this, if you undertook the practice of meditation without first having studied Scripture, you see the problem? It's the study of Scripture that at least can give you the paroksha jnana, and we have to come back to this in the next class. The point is without gaining knowledge, what are you meditating on? The source of that knowledge is Scripture. So scriptural study comes first, and then later is supported by meditation. There's much more to be said here. So we'll come back to this verse in the next class. Some final announcements here. Tomorrow, Sunday, once a month, we have this lovely meditation program of chanting. and some stotras. And tomorrow we're actually going to be drawing upon a meditation that's found in the Padma Purana. This meditation is guaranteed to transport you to another loka entirely. It's the most amazing meditation you'll ever see. So we do this once a month. We're doing it tomorrow at 6:15. So please come and join us for this chanting and meditation tomorrow at 6:15. Then Monday at 6 p.m. is a program. You know that we have this Jana Raksha program, which provides support to community members who need some personal support. Vasanti is organizing a caregiver support group for caregivers of patients who are suffering from different kinds of dementia or Parkinson's, other kinds of similar illnesses. So the caregivers need a lot of support because the patients require so much care. So her caregiver support group will meet at the Franklin Township Library Monday at 6 p.m. And there are flyers out in the hallway. You can get more information on that. Then, just to give you a mark your calendars, in 3 weeks we're celebrating our 18th anniversary. So May 6th, Saturday, 3 weeks from now. Probably not May. June. Good. Yes. June 6th? 9th. It says May 6th. So go figure. So, June what? Okay, June 9th. I'll take your word for it. June 9th, three weeks from now, we'll celebrate our 18th anniversary. We have a really nice program planned. Mark your calendars. Plan on joining us at that time. Library will be open for class. Library will be open after class. We'll conclude with our prayers.